Shrink Wrap Radio number 454, Scientific Research on the Effects of Meditation with Dr. Clifford Seren.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Dr. Clifford Seren, and we'll be speaking about his scientific research on the effects of meditation. For more information about Dr. Clifford Seren, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Before we go to the interview, I want to let all you professionals know that our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, has created CE courses from selected Shrink Wrap Radio interviews on topics such as dreams, relationships, synchronicity, trauma, and more. Go to www.jungplatform.com to see the latest courses. Now, here's today's interview. Dr. Clifford Seren, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
Well, Dr. Ron Purser, who I also interviewed here, suggested that you'd be a great person to interview on meditation, and also that you're going to be one of the keynoters at the upcoming conference on mindfulness and compassion. Mm-hmm. And we can talk more about that at the end of the interview. Let me ask you, when and how did you first become interested in meditation?
It's a wonderful question. I discovered at a meditation retreat when I was about 27 that I really had been interested in meditation since I was a child.
Since you were a child?
I was an asthmatic child. I was often extremely sick. And whenever I would go to summer camp, inevitably the mold would cause me to have asthma attacks. I'd wind up being in the infirmary when all my friends were playing, and I would be convalescing. And because severe asthma is a terrifying kind of disease where you cannot breathe, when one is relieved of symptoms, one becomes incredibly grateful just to be able to breathe.
Sure.
So I found myself sitting at the window of the infirmary, just watching my breath, grateful to be alive. Then I realized, many years later, having been introduced to Buddhist Vipassana meditation by Joseph Goldstein over 40 years ago at that first class at Naropa.
Wow.
1974. When I was later at the Insight Meditation Society, sitting a retreat in the Berkshires near where I'd gone to summer camp, there I was, sitting by a window, watching my breath, grateful to be alive. And I sort of said, wow, I've been doing this a while, but it wasn't really so formalized. But I became interested in the fact that there were ways to pay attention to one's mind that were not so didactic. Just by growing up in the 60s and listening to WBAI in New York, the Pacifica station that we have out here, and hearing Krishnamurti and Alan Watts, and in high school it was Ram Dass, and you know, there was humanistic psychology.
Hey, you're right on my channel with all of that. I totally relate to all of that. Was meditation a part of your doctoral research? I know you're a big meditation researcher now. Did it begin then?
Well, my doctoral dissertation was actually not on meditation at all, but it was, in fact, inspired a little bit by it. But it was on interhemispheric visuomotor integration, But I was really interested in intra-individual differences. That is, moment to moment, how does your brain response change when you have to do the simplest of tasks, like press a button when you see a flash of light?
Mm-hmm.
So I actually had people doing that thousands and thousands of times, looking at variability in their behavioral responses and correlating that with changes in their electrocortical activity. The notion that within the same experimental condition, doing the same task across the span of many hours, one is doing it quite differently time to time, is consistent with the sort of phenomenology of paying attention to how one experiences the world differently moment to moment.
Yeah. But, well, I wanted to share with you that a part of my own doctoral research did involve studying meditation and attention at the University of Michigan, but that was way back in 1970, and I didn't have any of the tools that you have today. There were no brain scans or anything like that. I just had people pressing a button every time they brought their mind back to their breath or to a candle.
Well, people still do that. And the other piece of the story for me is that before I was immersed in completing my doctoral dissertation, my life had been irrevocably altered as a graduate student by the opportunity in 1990 to fill in for Richie Davidson in the third Mind and Life Conference.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So I was actually in the midst of classes, and I had to get excused from a protein biochemistry class because Richie was unable to go and kindly asked me when we met at a psychophysiology meeting in Boston, would I like to go to Dharamsala in 3 weeks and give a talk to the Dalai Lama?
So that was a major turning point for you in your career.
That was a turning point. And they weren't so fast to let me out of the midterm, but they recognized that this might be an interesting life event. And so 3 weeks later, I was rooming with Francisco Varela in the Kashmir Cottage, the guest house that the Dalai Lama's youngest brother Tenzin Chogyo runs. It used to be his mother's home.
Well, what a fascinating experience to have had. Now, in your bio, I see that you were the lead coordinator for the Shamatha Project, and you might be interested to know that I interviewed one of your subjects in that project, Dr. Adeline Van Waning, who wrote a book about her experiences titled The Less Dust, The More Trust.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you're familiar with her and the book. It may be that not all my listeners heard that particular interview, so perhaps you can give us a quick overview of the structure of that project.
Sure. So this actually has its antecedents back in that fateful meeting with the Dalai Lama at Mind and Life 3. Alan Wallace was one of the translators, along with Thupten Jinpa, for that meeting. The meeting was published as Healing Emotions, edited by Danny Goldman.
Mm-hmm.
And at that meeting, there was an idea that we should do a study looking at using the nascent tools of cognitive neuroscience to look at the effects of advanced Tibetan mental training on attention and emotion. In the monks who were living in retreat on Baksu Mountain, Alan had been a monk for 14 years and was a practitioner of shamatha, or attention stabilization, meditative quiescence meditation. So in 1992, with funding from the Fetzer Institute, we actually embarked on a field research project. This involved Richie Davidson, Francisco Varela, Alan Wallace, Jose Cabezon, neuroscientist Greg Simpson, who was at UCSF for many years, and many others. And that project was remarkably, in many ways, inspiring, and in many ways, cross-culturally naive and methodologically challenged, because mm-hmm. we could not bring many of the instruments we had carted to India to these monks who were in retreat. And of course, the cross-cultural issues of even using a computer or understanding pictorial representation of pictures, as opposed to what one would see with one's eyes, made for a very different kind of experimental engagement with our participant monks.
Yeah, fascinating.
So at the end of that, it was clear that they were extraordinary human beings, but we could not tell whether or not they had always been extraordinary, and in part that's why they were on retreat.
Yeah.
As opposed to their qualities being the effects of training.
Right. So
we determined to do a longitudinal study in the West to sort of follow this up. So you now have to sort of jump cut from 1994 to 2007.
Whoop. Okay. I've been transported.
And both Alan Wallace and I had to finish our dissertations. We had to get positions. And I was at the Center for Mind and Brain, which was just beginning. And actually, the idea to do this longitudinal project began in 2003. But in 2007, we had amassed the funding, again, the majority from the Fetzer Institute and from the Hershey Family Foundation. And Alan's Santa Barbara Institute for Consciousness Studies and a variety of donors. And what we wanted to do is to do a longitudinal intensive study of the effects of a three-month retreat in a randomized waitlist control design. And we specifically were asking sort of the question, can attention be trained by focused attention meditation? And if it is, to what extent does that attentional training, in conjunction with practices to cultivate the four immeasurables, the Brahma Viharas, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, if that sort of a training package in a full-time retreat context has effects on one's emotion regulation, on one's engagement with suffering, on physiological responses that might be relevant for health. So we actually put together a very comprehensive 15 computer-based laboratory tasks. We built two state-of-the-art 96-channel psychophysiology labs in the large dorm room inside the Rigdon Meditation Hall at Shambhala Mountain Center. And I was incredibly fortunate to have the dedication of a group of students and full-time research associates and postdoctoral fellows and graduate students who gave remarkably of themselves to make this sort of major motion picture of a field study happen, as well as many people at Shambhala Mountain Center who helped create this. So we advertised worldwide and got 142 people who were willing to be randomly assigned to one of 2 3-month retreats. And if they were in the second retreat, they had to be willing to be flown to Colorado 3 times at the beginning, middle, and end of the first retreat so they could be comparison subjects. Because, of course, you've got, out of the starting gate, an incredibly self-selected group that's going to be able to do and interested in doing a 3-month-long retreat.
And these were all people who had some level of experience as meditators already. Isn't that the case or not?
Yeah, you can't just take somebody off the street and throw them into a 3-month retreat.
Uh-huh.
It's not generally seen as an ethical act. Because one really needs to have some maturity about what it is to sit with your mind.
So I guess you must have had to sort of check baseline levels and then see if there was improvement after 3 months.
So we did this in a number of ways. Of course, everybody knows that, you know, you just need to get assigned to an intervention, and already the assignment has
yeah.
Anybody who's had a high school senior get into college knows the day after they get their rejection or acceptance is a profound impact on the way they see themselves.
Yeah.
So we actually shipped laptop computers with 5 cognitive tasks to everyone in their homes with the same software we use in the laboratories and a sort of instruction toolkit so they could turn their closets, their bedrooms, their offices into little mini cognitive science laboratories. And we gave them a variety of attention, perception tasks, as well as a battery of questionnaires before they even knew which group they were going to be in.
Yeah, you referred earlier to this as a movie, and indeed it sounds like you were in the role of something fully as complex as a movie producer would find themselves.
Kind of. This project has, is graciously funded by the John Templeton Foundation and further funds from Fetzer and the Hershey Family Foundation and many, many donors. And we have raised over $5 million since we began to
get
this project going. And we've just completed a 7-year follow-up so that we can see how the meaning of this project played out in people's lives, not just the experimental data we collected. We've done follow-ups at 5 months, at a year and a half, and now 6 to 7 years, and we're doing qualitative as well as behavioral cognitive tasks.
Well, of course, we're interested in learning, you know, what did you find out? And we can proceed a couple of ways here. One is you sent me, I asked you if you had any reprints that I could study up for this interview. And so you sent me 9 journal articles of some degree of complexity. And so either we could kind of walk through those with you giving us a highlight from each article, or I can just sort of ask you in a general way, you know, what did you find out? Which of these two approaches would work best for you?
Well, I think that why don't we start with the general? And if you have questions about the particulars, we can delve into specific papers. And as I speak about the general, I will refer to the papers. How's that?
That sounds great.
And so the first question that we wanted to answer is, do people get better at sustained attention if they're going to spend hundreds of hours practicing focused, sustained attention in a contemplative context? And to measure that is not so simple. So Catherine McLean, who was a graduate student in the lab at the time, spent almost her whole graduate career developing a series of tasks that were extremely difficult and boring and perceptually demanding that drew on the attention, the continuous performance attention literature that stretches all the way back to testing radar operators in World War II to see what is the vigilance capability of human beings. There's a very well-known vigilance decrement. People begin to lose the capacity to pay sustained attention 5 to 10 minutes after you ask them to do a difficult task where they have to notice an infrequent, slightly perceptible event. So
reminds me of graduate school in general.
Yes.
College too.
So this task involved detecting a tiny difference in the length of a very briefly presented line. The difference between a long line, which was a non-target, and a short line, which was a target, was determined by a psychophysical perceptual threshold stair-step procedure that we conducted for each person. So we, you know, some people have really sharp eyes, and a small amount of difference might be very easy for them, and someone else might not be able to see that difference at all. So for them, the same difficulty would actually be a shorter line compared to the standard non-target. So we did this psychophysical perceptual threshold procedure for everybody at the beginning, middle, and end of the retreat. So we were able to make sure that everyone's difficulty level was the same at the beginning, middle, and end. And we thought in the first retreat, what we would do is we would have a sustained attention task and see whether people for 32 minutes without a break could press a button only when they saw a short line. And short lines happened about 1 in 10 long lines randomly, and lines came about every 2 seconds. So you're going to have about 1,000 stimuli. You got about 100 times you're supposed to press the button. The short line is barely perceptible. That is to say, 75% of the time you can see it. That's the definition of perceptual threshold. 25% of the time, you don't even know it's there. So it's right at your level of perceptual ability. And now we're going to ask you to press the button, vigilantly looking for these short lines for 32 minutes. No breaks.
Sounds challenging.
It's very challenging, but if you're going to spend hundreds of hours sitting and watching your breath or whatever the object of meditation will be for you, we thought that we needed to give the expert's training that one is receiving a good shakedown in terms of the assessment. Well, we did this, and in the first retreat, we didn't get improvements in the slope of the vigilance decrement. We did not see what we expected to see.
Yeah, that must have been disappointing and alarming.
Well,
with millions of dollars riding on it.
Well, what's really interesting is what we did find is that as people went through the training, their perceptual thresholds improved. So what we wound up doing is we gave the meditators progressively harder tasks. The control group did not change its visual perceptual threshold, but across the duration of the training, the retreat group did change. So we actually stacked the deck against the retreat group by giving them, relative to the control group, on average, a harder task.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we realized that at the end of the first retreat. So we said, we have another retreat coming up. Let's change one thing. Let's establish the perceptual threshold at the beginning and then keep it there throughout the duration of the 3 months. We'll still measure it every time, but people will get, at the mid and the post-test, the same physical stimulus they got at the beginning. And when we did that, lo and behold, we found that there was an improvement in the vigilance decrement. And that improvement was in fact related to the improved perceptual thresholds. So what that meant is that for all things being equal, the detection of this hard-to-discriminate stimulus became more vivid with training. So we've published these results, McLean et al. In Psychological Science in 2010. So that was the first paper we published from the study. And it already had an interesting thing we didn't expect.
Okay.
But overall, perception got sharper. And to the extent people's perception got sharper, their vigilance decrement, at least within the first 16 minutes of this 32-minute task, showed an improved sustained capacity for attention. But what is sustained attention? How do you think about that? One of the things we're doing now, 7 years later, Siobhan Powers and Tony Zanesco in the lab have spent a huge amount of time cleaning the EEG data we got from 88 channels of scalp electrodes during the performance of this task. And we're now engaged in looking at whether or not changes in cortical activation precede the stimulus, such that after you make a response, do you replenish your attentional resources by relaxing, even for 1 second, and then attend again? Because we know we have limited attentional resources. Attention restoration theory from William James, and you know, it's over 100 years. It's been articulated that when you take a walk in a natural environment, your attention is restored. John Ioannidis in University of Michigan published a great paper in Psych Science, Berman et al., showing that if you walk in an urban area versus an arboretum and you do a difficult NBAC memory task, the walk in the arboretum improves your performance. The walk downtown improves it much less. So can you take that kind of attention restoration theory and move it inside so that one can conceptualize contemplative practice as a kind of movement in a natural environment, which is your mind? Don't know yet.
Yeah, we have
10 terabytes of EEG data. So That is true. This is a kind of endless project. It's kind of like Space Lab goes into the monastery. So this notion that sustained attention actually is not sustained like isometric contraction of a in terms of exercise, but really what is sustained is a flux. Is a kind of, this is our hypothesis, that what is learned in these practices is a capacity to engage and disengage and engage again and disengage. And that disengagement allows for the apparent maintenance of attentional resources over time, because you deploy, expend, restore. It's a kind of micro notion of this classic, you know, engage and withdraw from the world when you're doing it on a second-by-second basis. They may well. Hopefully there'll be a paper soon published by my friends Antoine Lutz, Amishi Jha, John Dunn, and myself that we've spent the last several years trying to articulate a seven-dimensional model of cognitive capacities cultivated by contemplative practice that involves object selection and sort of meta-awareness, so that your awareness of the task at hand becomes more salient, your mind wandering may be able to be detected more quickly, one's capacity for focus and stability may increase. So at this point, we're hoping that that will be in press soon. So this paper has been long in coming. So one of the important theoretical views of how meditative practice might be of utility in fostering compassion would be a training that allows one to move from a sense of empathic distress or aversion to the perception of suffering to more in a direction of being able to sit with or engage with suffering, whether it's arising in yourself or in others. Because we often tend to be averse to suffering. I mean, it's kind of natural. You want to move away from pain. You want to move toward things that are pleasant. So this experiment, this paper, is first author is Erica Rosenberg, and two graduate students had a huge amount to do as well with the data in this paper, Tony Zanesco and Brandon King. What we did, and this is kind of inspired by work that Erica did as a graduate student with Paul Ekman at UCSF, is we searched for difficult-to-watch film clips that depicted human suffering. And we presented them to individuals in an experimental setting where what we were asking them to do was simply to watch the movie. These were 2 or 3 minute film clips. After they saw the movie, we asked them to rate, looking at a storyboard, how their emotions changed during seeing the film. And then after they rated, we asked them to sort of just speak a little bit about their experience. We haven't coded those sort of self-interviews yet. But what we then did, and this is, you know, really a testament to the Talmudic patience of Eric and Tony and Brandon, is that we used Paul Ekman and Wally Friesen's facial action coding system, which every single frame of video, whenever there's any visually detectable muscle movement of any of the 46 muscle groups of the face, the action unit of muscles is noted. The moment of initial contraction, the moment of peak contraction, and the moment of the offset of contraction is noted, and the intensity of that peak contraction is noted. Frame, and this is not scanning for emotion expressions. This is scanning for every single possible detectable muscle movement. So sometimes people make mouth movements habitually. Each one of those had to be coded. You raise your eyebrow, it's coded. You purse your lips, it's coded. Frame by frame. So this, it takes about 150 minutes to code 1 minute. This is unobtrusively obtained video recording. We, of course, debriefed people and got their permission to be able to use this. And after thousands of hours of coding, because we had about 30 people per group, beginning and end films, we then take this objective spatiotemporal database of musculature and can apply an emotion dictionary to the configurations of action unit contractions that co-occur and come up with a kind of unbiased, what emotion would the face be in? What emotion would most people interpret that facial configuration as representing? You know, you could just look at somebody and say, hey, he looks angry or sad, but that's not how you can do that scientifically. And in the interval between when we started this and now, there actually are computer programs that are pretty good at being able to do this automatically, but they did not exist at that time.
Wow.
So we did this all by hand, and what we found is we kind of thought about two different emotional response patterns. One that was kind of aversive to suffering, and this would be either anger, contempt, or disgust expressions. What might someone show if they were not being aversive or showing a kind of rejection of what the input is? Well, they might be sad. They might look distressed. So what we found when we did all this, and this is now in press in the journal Emotion, we found that compared to the beginning of the retreat, at the end of the retreatants showed a higher probability of showing sadness than the control group. Now, this is a matched control group. They're going to do a 3-month retreat. They're drawn from the same population that is in the first retreat group. They're matched on many different dimensions in terms of self-reported psychological traits, as well as their cognitive performance on a variety of tasks. So they don't differ on this at the beginning, but at the end, the retreatants are more likely to show sadness. But if they show sadness, they show about the same number of expressions across the film. The film we showed them was an excerpt from a documentary about the Iraq War, with very difficult to observe images of injured children and soldiers who were getting pumped up about going out to kill the enemy or then showing remorse.
Would this, might some people interpret this as meaning that becoming a meditator would, you'd be more inclined to be sad and upset by things in the world?
Well, this is actually really interesting, and we're going to get there. In terms of rejection emotions, the hypothesis was that there would be less rejection at the end of the retreat. And in fact, the retreat group showed significantly fewer rejection expressions than the control group. They showed an equal likelihood to show rejection, but if they did show rejection, they showed fewer rejection expressions, anger, contempt, or disgust. And what this, we sort of interpret this to mean that, well, it's not that you can't have negative affect, but once you detect that in yourself, there may be a whole host of responses that can come online that examine what gave rise to that feeling and shifts the way you frame next moments of perception.
Mm-hmm.
So we specifically asked people what they were feeling when we thought they were looking sad. And we did that by going back to the emotion rating data that they did on the basis of the storyboard of the film clip. So we actually had a kind of time series of affect ratings across the duration of the film. So we pegged in time when they showed what we thought was sadness and what they said they felt. And in the retreat group, when we thought they looked sad, they did not say they were sad. They said they were feeling sympathy, not sadness.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a relationship that was statistically significant for that, and that relationship did not exist in the control group. So we interpret that as suggesting that rather than showing sadness, they were showing an other-directed manifestation of empathic concern.
Okay, well, you have really established your meticulous approach to doing scientific research in this domain. In the interest of time, I'm going to ask you to pull way back from method and to give us some of the high-level findings, if there are other high-level findings beyond those that you've already told us about.
Sure, I can do that fairly briefly. So we actually took that vigilance experiment and we flipped it around and we made it a task where you have to push the button every single time it's not a target. And then you have to withhold pushing the button when it is a target. So in this experiment, rather than pushing a button 100 times in 32 minutes to get perfect performance, you'd have to push the button 960 times and withhold 100 times. So you get into a habit of pushing the button.
Yeah.
And that's a kind of executive control response inhibition task. So the idea is that a lot about being willing to sit is to be with whatever comes up. So if you feel bored, you don't just get up because you're bored and go read the paper. You examine boredom. So contemplative training in an intensive context is a lot about response inhibition as much as it is about observation of phenomena as they arrive. So what we found in both retreat groups, and this is a paper that was first author is Baljinder Sadra. It was published in the journal Emotion in 2011, is that in fact response inhibition improved in both retreats over time, over the full span of 32 minutes. But even more importantly, to the extent that an individual improved in this capacity to withhold habitual responses, their self-reported psychological adaptive functioning, an amalgam of many different self-report instruments having to do with openness to new experience and mindfulness and resilience and less anxiety and less depression, a kind of latent construct that we call adaptive functioning, that was statistically significantly related at an individual basis to improvements in response inhibition.
Okay.
That's that paper. Another finding, and we've replicated this response inhibition finding. Tony Zanesco published this in Frontiers in Human Neuroscience, along with a number of other co-authors. So this was looking at a one-month Vipassana retreat at Spirit Rock here in Marin. And he also showed that people's reaction time variability decreased when they were trained for a month sitting silent retreat, Vipassana retreat. And that was also related to aspects of concentration that people felt in terms of their subjective experience. So we have some very interesting data with respect to things that might be relevant to health and longevity. We published a paper in Psychoneuroendocrinology from the Shamatha Project. First author was Tanya Jacobs, and this is done in collaboration with Alyssa Eppel and Zhu Lin and Liz Blackburn at UCSF. And we measured the enzyme telomerase in circulating peripheral blood monocytes. Telomerase is the enzyme that repairs the shortening of your telomeres, or the caps at the end of your chromosomes. Telomere length is materially related to longevity.
Yes, I've heard that.
Stress can downregulate telomerase.
Right. What did you find?
So when we measured telomerase, we found that it had been raised by about 30% at the end of the retreat in the control in the retreat group compared to the control group. But that finding in itself was not as interesting as asking a question: was there anything that related psychological change during the retreat to the level of telomerase at the end of the retreat? And we found that a change in the sense of purpose in life, as assessed by Carol Riff's well-being questionnaire, predicted significantly greater telomerase at the end of the retreat. We also found this for a sense of environmental mastery, the degree to which you feel like you're in control of your circumstances of your life. And we found it was inversely related to change in neuroticism. If people became less neurotic as one of the five factors of personality in the Big Five inventory, they had greater levels of telomerase. Now, we didn't measure in that study telomere length. This is the enzyme, not the DNA length. But we're doing that now in a study we did a couple of years ago at Spirit Rock. And so we hope to have some, and we have promising data there that is not fully analyzed, so I can't go into it here.
Okay. You mentioned that you met with the Dalai Lama a month ago. Is there anything that you would be interested in sharing with our audience about that meeting or your experience of the Dalai Lama?
Well, my life since 1990 has been fortunately touched by what I thought was a once-in-a-lifetime occurrence. And then primarily through my involvement with the Mind and Life Institute over many years, I've had a number of opportunities to present data to His Holiness the Dalai Lama and to be in his close presence for many, many hours during the Mind and Life meetings in different contexts. So in the meeting I was just at, it was at the University of Delhi, and it was on ethics, education, and science. And I actually was presenting to him the data from the film study that I've just spoken about, as well as this seven-dimensional phenomenological model of mindfulness that I've been working on with Antoine Lutz and Amishi Jha and John Dunn. And also presenting to him the fact that within this society at this point, mindfulness is prevalent in the press, in corporations, in many factors of society, and what exactly people think they're doing with it seems to be a broad spectrum of things. One of the articles in the press I showed him was an article that was published in Bloomberg News and a magazine, Bloomberg Pursuits, which says if you want to make a killing on Wall Street, start meditating. And I'm in that article. And I'm in that article because of the visual perceptual threshold data from the first study I talked to you about today.
Yeah.
Because people on Wall Street want to hack their brains and develop powers of perception to get ahead. They call it brain hacking, to make more money.
Yeah.
So that's a kind of internal high-frequency trading. So the question arises, what are the ethics of harnessing a contemplative practice that emerges from a profound ethical frame?
Right.
And using it instrumentally in this fashion. So while there's many positive reasons to, in multiple contexts, promote the kind of conditions that could give rise to the natural occurrence of wisdom or compassion or insight about one's mind, the frame in which one and the motivation in which one uptakes these practices is, I think, really important. So I was kind of talking about that as well. The Dalai Lama is a remarkable example of what I would call a long-enduring mind. He, at one point, was talking about how his experience of Buddhist philosophy and insights shifted decade by decade by decade over the last 60 years.
Oh, fascinating.
And so just to hear someone speak about these sort of periods and the arc of their unending development was sort of reminiscent of, you know, the way a great artist might talk about their organic maturing over time because of the coherence of their sustained commitment to very important views they hold.
Yeah. Well, you know, as we wind down here, and I think that what you've just said kind of leads into this, I understand you're going to be one of the presenters at the upcoming Mindfulness and Compassion Conference at San Francisco State University, June 3rd through the 7th, 2015. Tell our listeners why they should attend the Mindfulness and Compassion Conference.
Well, if you're interested in this area, there will be a number of important, thoughtful, considered researchers who will be giving talks, teachers who will be giving talks, and it is a forum for the presentation of much ongoing research in the form of posters and other talks. There are a couple of graduate students and a project scientist in my own lab that will be presenting aspects of our data at this meeting. But, you know, there is a, if you're interested in the field, both in terms of practice, clinical effects, basic research, this should be an important meeting. There are precious few opportunities for this nascent field to gather in ways that can be at once self-critical as well as a survey of the landscape.
Do you know what you're presenting on yet?
It'll be related to these issues of further data from the Shamatha Project as well as this model of mindfulness that we've been working on, and again, cautions about the importance of context in accounting for scientific findings. Often, yeah. Research designs do not include active controls or do not take into account the motivational frame of a given teacher. So you cannot reduce things to a simple description of technique. It's very difficult to know what people actually do when there's no overt behavioral measure of meditating.
Yeah, I myself have sort of somewhat jokingly have remarked a number of times here that we seem to be in the midst of a mindfulness bubble with all the coverage in the press and, as you point out, being used in so many different ways in different contexts and to different purposes.
Yeah, I mean, I've lived from being sort of referred to with little respect when I was in graduate school for being interested in this, and now it is widely promulgated.
Yeah. What a ride. And in fact, you know, when I was in graduate school and graduating in 1970, the people on my committee had no idea, you know, what I was doing or why I was interested in it, but they were just willing to support me. There was very little research at that time on the sorts of things that we're discussing. And I'm just wondering, you're at a major university, University of California, Davis. Has this set of interests caused you any problems in terms of your academic career?
Not at all. Quite the contrary. In fact, this year, our research summit at the Center for Mind and Brain is actually on these issues. And it's called Perspectives on Mindfulness, the Complex Role of Scientific Research on Meditation. So no, there's been tremendous interest and tremendous support. And there's a recognition that there is a deep need to bring a phenomenal perspective into psychology and neuroscience so that the lived experience connects with whatever physiological dependent measures and rigorous analytic tools and experimental designs that we create, so that our view of the human mind as we see it displayed in its broad repertoire of capacities has an adequate regard.
Okay, well, we could go on and on for hours, I'm sure, but we can't do that. So, Dr. Clifford Sarin, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks a lot, David.
The thing that stands out to me from this conversation with Dr. Clifford Seren is the painstaking lengths he and his team have gone to in order to subject meditation to rigorous research. Their Shamatha project is truly a monumental undertaking. His analogy of it being something along the lines of producing a major motion picture is quite apt in terms of all the preparation required and the teams of people and resources that needed to be coordinated. My hat's off to him and everyone involved in this groundbreaking project. By the way, if you didn't hear my interview with Dutch participant in the Shamatha project, Adeline van Waning, MD, PhD, who also wrote The Less Dust, The More Trust, you can find it on the Shrink Wrap Radio episode number 390. And, of course, you can also find her excellent book by the same title on Amazon.com using the Amazon widget in our right-hand sidebar. Finally, let me give one last plug for the Mindfulness and Compassion Conference that's taking place on the San Francisco State University campus June 3rd through the 7th of 2015. And you can find complete information about the speakers and sessions by clicking on the banner ad for the conference in the left-hand sidebar of our website. I expect to be attending myself, so if you're able to be there, be sure to come up and say hi.
Hello, Dr. Dave. This is Morgan Adolfsen from Norway, clinical psychologist. I've been a long-time listener to both Wise Counsel and Shrink Wrap Radio. Today, I'm so happy that I pressed the donate button. So from this day, I will regularly contribute to support your shows. And I really appreciate your work, Dave. So good luck. Thank you.
Thank you, Norwegian psychologist Morgan Adolfsen, for your strong recommendation. Actually, Dr. Adolfsen sent that endorsement in some time back, but I'm happy to report that he continues to be a regular listener and financial donor. Won't you please join him in helping to support Shrink Wrap Radio? In fact, we do have five additions for our honor roll, and they are Kathleen Van Dyke, Sarah Hatch, Catherine S. Kurtz, Jennifer Joyce Solomon, and Penny McKenna, who actually doubled her monthly commitment. Way to go. We also have some other ways you can help to support the show, of course. For example, we have an iTunes affiliate link in our left-hand sidebar that you can use to buy things from the iTunes store. Also, you can use our Amazon.com widget in our right-hand sidebar to buy not just books, but anything that Amazon sells, which is pretty much everything. The trick to going to non-book products with our widget is to click on the black area at the bottom of the widget where it says Search New and Used, and that will take you to the Amazon site and you can search for whatever you're interested in buying, and our affiliate code will be attached to whatever you buy. It costs you nothing extra, and it does donate a small percentage to help support the podcast. If you remember to do that for all your Amazon searching and shopping, it can add up. So thanks for remembering to do that. And of course, another way to support us is to join Audible.com if you're not already a member. My Audible.com recommendation today is a perfect companion piece for this podcast on the effects of meditation. The title is Mindfulness for Beginners by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who is probably the person most responsible for bringing mindfulness practice into widespread use in psychotherapy. And this 2.5-hour presentation is read by Kabat-Zinn himself. This is a great opportunity for you to get it straight from this pioneer's mouth and in a bite-sized dose at that. This audio presentation can be yours for free and to keep by signing up at audibletrial.com/shrink, where they have around 180,000 other titles for you to choose from. And remember, there's no obligation for you to continue your subscription. However, if you're anything like me, you'll probably want to, because I've been an Audible.com subscriber for just about forever. And it's also a great gift, and I'm happy to say I've been on the receiving end, being gifted by family members over the years. Finally, thanks to all of you who sent birthday greetings, my birthday having been May 3rd. It feels a little shameless to mention it here on the air, but hey, so much of my life is public, so why not?
Hi, this is Christopher Van Nuys, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, good son Christopher. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. I'll read just one, and it's from Vicky in London, who writes, "Hello, Dave. Often I listen to your podcasts on my walk to work and think, yes, must follow that up and even get in touch with you. And as you know, once you get to work and the day kicks in, then it's not till you are falling asleep that you remember to actually do it. I listened to this one twice because I enjoyed it so much and was also struck by the fact that you read out loud an email from Laura Joost, who mentions that she is a therapist in London who listens as she runs along the river, and I listen as I walk across Waterloo Bridge. So I couldn't forget that. Great podcast and chimed with me. Looking on Gary Bobroff's website, I was pleased to see he'll be doing a seminar over here later this year, which I will try to attend. I was interested that you were or have been so dismissive or uninterested in archetypes and means of categorizing people's attitudes. We do quite a bit of market research at work and often use segmentation as a way to understand customer and potential customer behavior. I know you have a market research background. I wondered if there was any overlap between the disciplines, or were you aware of the archetypes being used in this way? In fact, as I type this, I'm recalling the interview you did from around 18 months ago with someone who had developed tarot cards for marketing purposes. Anyway, just a couple of thoughts and to let you know I appreciate the show. I'm nowhere near this field professionally, but I always find something useful in there. Regards, Vicky." Well, Vicky, thanks for taking time to email me, and I'm glad to hear that Shrink Wrap Radio has chimed with you. I have to say, that's not an expression I've run into before, but the meaning seems quite clear. I'm glad you enjoyed the interview with Gary Bobroff and are looking forward to his archetypal workshop over there. I've had some experience, in fact, using archetypes in my market research work, and certainly that tarot deck you referred to, designed by my friend, former and future guest, Dr. Sharon Livingston, has been a useful tool in my work as well. By the way, I do have another interview with her planned for the future. I'm also happy to recommend an excellent book by psychologist Carol Pearson, who has written a classic book by the title of The Hero and the Outlaw, Building Extraordinary Brands Through the Power of Archetypes. You'll find other books on archetypes by her if you look on Amazon. So I'll close with that one and wrap it up for today. As always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Cliff Sarin, for sharing his extensive research on meditation outcomes. My next interview will be with Jungian analyst Rose Emily Rothenberg, and we'll be discussing her newest book about her own healing journeys to Africa and the renewal of her spirit that ensued. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. We'll be right back.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.